Castellano, Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Joseph Castellano. Your Honor, there is no question that fraud occurred in this case, and there is absolutely no question that Mr. Castellano had a role in that fraud. However, what the district court and the government have seemed to forget is that he was not the only actor in this fraud. And that error by the district court resulted in a much higher sentence for Mr. Castellano than was warranted. First and foremost is the sentencing guideline enhancement for affecting a financial institution and receiving more than $1 million in gross receipts. The first prong of
that... What were the gross receipts total in this case?
Well, Your Honor, that is also... a bit of a contested issue. We contested both restitution and amount of loss.
Those are net, right? There's a dispute about whether the net is $1.5 million or $1 million or something else. What were the gross receipts?
They were, the probation officer's calculation was that the gross receipts were about $2.2 million. And that was
the total amount of money that was extended by banks.
I don't think that amount was ever calculated. Exactly.
Right. So what you're saying is that nobody ever calculated the gross. People were fixated on calculating the net loss.
I believe that's what happened in this case.
But the guideline talks about the gross, not about the net.
Correct. Which is, I think the root of our problem here is that the guidelines instruct the district court to make these individual findings regarding each defendant, including the corporate defendant, and what they individually received from the offense. And with no individual findings, it's impossible in this case to attribute over $1 million in gross receipts to Mr. Castellano.
And what happened to Monty? Well,
Monty Castellano, you mean as far as the criminal case, Your Honor?
Yeah.
He pled guilty. He testified on the government's behalf. He was sentenced. I believe he's finished.
Well, was he subjected to this gross receipts provision also? You have this work. Do you have them all? You don't have them. Do you aggregate them or what?
The gross receipts?
Yes. Could Monty have also been deemed to have received millions in gross receipts?
Well, cases from other circuit courts indicate that the district court must split up the gross receipts and appropriate
them. Okay, so how much was ascribed to, attributed to Monty?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of that. The government could probably answer that question because Mr. Goldsmith was at Monty's sentencing. What I do know, obviously, is that they were not done in this case. And other circuit courts who have considered this issue have looked to not the defendant's role in the offense, which is a separate sentencing guideline enhancement, but the defendant's role in the company. And most cases where this enhancement is applied, the defendant was the sole owner and only actor, in many cases, in the company. And he was using the company to funnel all of the gross receipts into his personal bank accounts or for his personal use. In this case, the court must remember that this was a legitimate company building legitimate homes using legitimate loan proceeds for much of the time it operated. Therefore, the court has to consider what was attributable to the offense and what was attributable to the company actually getting loan proceeds as part of their business and then paying off subcontractors' salaries, rent, supplies, and other legitimate business expenses. The circuit court in the Second Circuit...
I don't see why that would matter. You're back to net again. The fact that the company used some of the gross receipts to pay legitimate expenses and therefore the net was lower, doesn't seem relevant under the guidelines, which talk about, that's why it talks about gross rather than net.
Right, and I agree with you, Your Honor. I believe that part of the problem here is that the other circuits who have considered this, I don't think have made an appropriate distinction between net and gross. For example, the Fourth Circuit in the Colton case said that the court must consider what went to corporate obligations before considering what gross receipts were. I'm not sure that's an accurate interpretation of the statute.
Should it be an alter ego test that if Castellano could have been sued for debt of the corporation, he therefore is the recipient of the gross receipts that the corporation received?
That seems to be the direction other circuit courts are taking.
Well, what is the direction you want?
I believe that the direction in this case should be...
Well, how about a general principle?
A legal rule, which we can then apply to this case.
I believe a general rule is to follow the guidelines commentary of gross receipts, which determines gross receipts.
That's not doing anything. The question is, when should gross receipts received by an entity be ascribed to an individual? So you could say, you know, well, if the corporation just the alter ego, that would be one approach. You don't apparently like that. So what approach would you suggest?
I don't necessarily not like that. I believe that's probably the most workable approach.
All right. And you like it. So how do we apply it here?
Well, you have to look at Mr. Castellano's role in the company.
Right.
And he was not the sole owner and not the sole actor in the company.
Actually, those criteria are unrelated to things like alter ego and piercing the corporate veil. You can easily have the corporate veil pierced even though there are two people involved in a company, or three, or indeed ten.
Correct.
If we were to apply to this case the standard corporate law criteria for looking through the corporate existence to the natural persons behind it, what would happen?
I believe that you would look to Monte Castellano, who is the 100% shareholder,
those aren't the criteria in corporate law.
Well, Your Honor, the basis that I have is what other circuit courts have done, and I believe is based in corporate law, while at the same time following the guidelines and considering what the guidelines ascribe to as far as how each defendant is.
I think you'd be arguing that this was a substantial corporation and, you know, is adequately capitalized and so on, and wasn't being used to deceive people as to its answerability to debt.
There was no pretense of unlimited liability. Wasn't obvious. You know, it didn't purport to be a proprietorship when in fact there was a shield of limited liability behind it. Those are the kinds of things that in corporate law might be important. Or maybe somebody would look to whether the board kept good minutes.
Well, unfortunately, when you get into those questions in this case, those aren't necessarily part of the record.
Well, that should be, I don't understand your defensiveness. This is what you should be arguing.
Yeah.
No, I understand.
You would say the burden is on the prosecutor, and if the prosecutor didn't put any of this stuff in the record, good for you.
Right, Your Honor. I was trying to make it clear to the court that part of the reason it's difficult for me to argue specifics is because it's not in the record. There's no indication of how we could do this, aside from remanding for some sort of determination on this. If the court will allow, I will move to the second issue, the abusive position of trust, which is another situation where the district court made an error in assessing the defendant. The government must prove, of course, that the defendant occupied a position of trust and use that position of trust with respect to the victims to facilitate the commission of the offense. The government concedes that Mr. Castellano did not have a formal position of trust in this case and argues that...
Didn't he, in effect, appoint himself the agent for the homeowners, home buyers, in dealing with the bank? So he says to him, look, you know, you don't have to deal with the bank. I'll deal with the bank for you, so I'm your agent. And the agent has fiduciary obligations to his principal.
He did not go that far, and as the court must look at it from the victim's perspective, the victims went into the bank and signed a separate agreement with the bank. They also were told that the bank and the title company would be reviewing the progress of the homes and assessing whether the
But he told them that he would take care of the disbursements by the bank. He would deal with the bank so far as disbursements to builders, to him for progress payments.
To himself. He explained the process that was contractually
right.
agreed upon.
He was going to take care of it. They wouldn't have to worry about the progress payment. So isn't that asking them to trust him and thus putting himself in a fiduciary position?
I certainly believe that he asked them to have confidence in him and trust as a home builder.
No, there's nothing in having confidence and actually delegating a responsibility to someone. If you do that, say, be my agent, I don't want to deal with these banks.
Right. You're correct, Your Honor, and I believe that's the distinction in this case, and other courts have made that distinction, that confidence is one thing that does not necessarily mean that there has been abuse of a position of trust. And in this case, where you have so many layers between the customer and the home builder, such as the title company, which had to approve the draw request, and the bank, which had to issue the checks on the draw request, both of which the customers understood were going to review the progress of the homes and ensure that they were appropriately being, the funds were appropriately being drawn. And I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay.
I'll use the rest of my time for
rebuttal. Okay, thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Goldsmith?
Good morning. If it pleases the court, Hal Goldsmith on behalf of the United States. It was the government's position at sentencing that, in fact, what the defendant, J.D. Castellano, had perpetrated was in the way of a Ponzi scheme. And we put forth to the court that the proper measure or calculation of loss would be to look at the gross receipts, that is, the monies that went into the company, J.D. and Company, less any collateral.
What is your view about when gross receipts of a corporation are attributed to one of the managers or an investor in the corporation?
When the facts and circumstances suggest that particular individual was in a position to control those monies in very discretionary...
And what establishes that rule of law? That's not the rule of law that would be used, say, for determining who is taxable on it,
right,
and who would be payable, who would be answerable on a tort judgment or a contract judgment. Why this different rule of law here?
There are cases that I cited in my brief and that talk about how much discretion.
But where does the rule of law come from? I understand a rule coming from corporate law, right? That would be the rule for piercing the corporate veil. I understand a rule coming from the text of the guidelines, but you don't appear to be relying on anything in the text of the guidelines or its commentary. So where does this attribution rule come from?
Good. I can't specifically answer that at this point. I believe that the cases that have looked at this type of situation and the what Judge Herndon rested his finding on as far as the fact that this defendant, J.D. Castellano, did in fact receive more than $1 million in gross receipts that affected the financial solution, really rested upon the facts and circumstances that he heard throughout the entire trial.
We take rules of law and then we analyze the facts and circumstances of the case under rules of law. We can't just analyze the facts and circumstances of the case without a corresponding rule of law.
See, for example, would he be, on the portion of these gross receipts that are net, would he be taxable? Would the IRS say, well, you know, really, if nominally the money was received by the corporation, but actually received by you, that would be another approach to...
Judge, I think in this case, if we did look to the tax laws, and in all due respect, I haven't made that type of analysis, but I think that if we did look to the tax laws, again, looking at the facts here, all the money that came into that company was spent at the direction of J.D. Castellano. However, so
that
those money
is taxable to him.
That would be true with a
boss
of a corporation.
I understand it.
Decides how the receipts, or you know, how the revenues are spent.
What I was going to suggest, Judge, was that I believe under the tax laws, only those monies that were actually
but look,
personally
Yeah, but that's the point. So you don't have a tax analogy, and you don't have a corporate law analogy. So again, it's that Easterbrook's question: what is the approach that courts should take in cases such as this?
And again, I think that the court, as Judge Herndon did, should take the facts and look at, well, who controlled the money? Who committed the
fraud? Your test is control.
I believe that's the only way that in this case we can look at it, because what we have here
is maybe the only way in this case the judgment could be sustained, but that doesn't mean that's the right rule of law.
I understand that, Your Honor, but again, when you look at the guideline section and whether or not this individual obtained more than $1 million in gross receipts and it affected a financial institution, you have to apply.
It's a pretty important doctrine of general American law that corporations and their managers are distinct entities.
Judge, this is not a large corporation. This was a two or three.
This proposition is true even of small corporations,
Judge,
with the exceptions for piercing the corporate veil in state law. Where in tax law, if the corporation had declared itself under subchapter S, we don't know in this case whether this was an S corporation. I gather not. There are legal rules that determine when corporate receipts are attributed to persons. And I find it hard to say, as you seem to be saying, let's just throw the entire legal framework out the window and do something else, unless there's some rule of law requiring that.
Judge, again, I understand that there are small companies and there are large companies, but what Judge Herndon heard in this case was that this company did not operate as a corporation. It was incorporated solely because the defendant, J.D. Castellano, had filed prior bankruptcy and had credit problems, and therefore, when he recruited his son into the company several years after he began the company, he made Monte Castellano the sole shareholder. But the facts and evidence in the record reflected clearly that all the monies came into the control of J.D. Castellano personally, and that J.D. Castellano personally not only drew salary and used those funds to pay personally.
Okay, so that's just it. So you're saying this corporation is really a fraud to hide from Castellano's creditors. Is that what you're saying?
It was set up with Monte Castellano as the sole shareholder for that purpose, Your Honor.
Is that what the Judge Herndon said?
Well, that was the record, Judge. That's what Monte Castellano testified.
Yes, I know, but what did Judge Herndon say?
Judge Herndon found...
What was the standard?
Judge Herndon found that the evidence, and I'm citing to page 127 in the sentencing transcript, the evidence in the case was that really J.D. Castellano was not only the ringleader of the business, but he was everything in the business. He was paying his wife, although she was doing no work. The business was him. I mean, everybody was going to J.D. He ran the show. Monte answered to him. He made the decisions. He was the business. The money was coming in presumably to keep the business afloat, but also to keep him afloat. They were paying his expenses, personal and otherwise. The business was him.
You know, I don't want to make this any more complicated than it really is, but isn't the situation here that once this whole Ponzi scheme, House of Cards, fell apart, that there was over $1 million of loss, solid, hard money loss, and the banks had to reimburse these 27 people who bought houses that thought their houses were going to be built and weren't built.
That's right. They were more than $1 million in the hole when the House of Cards...
Wouldn't the facts of this case, it was a wire fraud or mail fraud or
something. Correct, it was a wire
fraud.
Couldn't
this also have been a RICO case?
Well, I think that it could have, but I don't... Again, in pleading the case and charging the case, I don't know that would have gotten us any, would have benefited...
Well, I think what Judge Evans is suggesting is you've been arguing that he uses this corporation as the device that he uses.
Correct.
For the instrument of fraud, which sounds...
It was. I mean, he couldn't have obtained these funds other than through his company. And so, to answer your question, I think under the law, it probably could have been. It was not, but it probably could have been. And again, at sentencing, we argued that you should look to the gross receipts because of the Ponzi scheme.
Did you ever calculate what the gross receipts were?
The gross receipts, yes, Judge, they were presented at trial. They were approximately $4 million. And what we presented at sentencing then was the gross receipts less the value of the collateral that remained.
Yeah, but the guidelines don't, that's a measure of net loss. The guidelines don't refer, at least for this enhancement, to net loss.
Not for
gross.
This. That's right. For losses under the guidelines, that's right.
There's a separate enhancement in the guidelines for the amount of loss. But this four-level thing is for gross receipts, and it's distinct from the amount of loss. So I'm quite puzzled why everybody then starts talking about net. It's just not what the guidelines say.
At the time of sentencing, the court took, all I can suggest is the court took what it believed to be a conservative view in determining the loss. It looked at it two different ways, intended loss because of the Ponzi scheme, and also the way that the United States Probation Office calculated it. Both of those losses figures were close. They came within the same guideline range.
Does intended loss and gross receipts, are those two separate enhancements?
Distinct enhancements.
No, I think when we look to determine the loss, it was the government's position that you should look to the intended loss because of the Ponzi. And we cited to Judge Herndon the Lauer case. And in that intended loss, you would look at the gross receipts that flowed through the company that came in because of the fraudulent representation, the fraud. And under the guidelines, you would give the defendant a credit for any value of collateral that was remaining. And that's how that's the suggestion we made to the court. And that's one of the ways that Judge Herndon found, one of the theories he followed in coming up with the loss calculation. The other way was what U.S. Probation had determined, and that was not to look at gross receipts, but to look at the losses to the different victims, the bank and the individual victim. I would like to address the abuse of position. As we put in our brief, clearly in this case, the defendant, J.D. Castellano, served as a fiduciary, as an agent for these home buyer victims. The home buyers came to him. He required them to go to his particular bank and his particular title company because, as he showed at trial, he knew that though the bank and the title company would not check and verify his work and that his false draw requests would be honored. The home buyer victims also signed agreements that allowed the defendant to draw those receipts and draw those disbursements without any further approval of the individual home buyer. So, in this case, every factor that...
Just with reference to the Marlett case, you treat the bank as a victim, and of course the individuals, the 27, were victims. Now, is there any double counting there?
No, there's no double counting in the figures, Judge, because the loss as far as the homes went to the bank because each of the home buyers, the bank forgave, if you will,
so
the construction loan.
So were they made whole? Or
the home buyer victims were ultimately made whole.
So the bank.
The bank took the loss by forgiving the loans in order to protect its collateral, which was out there. I mean, the money was out there without collateral. So there's no double counting in the figures. So the government's position that this defendant, J.D. Castellano, clearly violated and abused a position of trust with the individual home buyers, and that guideline enhancement was appropriate. Judge, if there are no further questions, the government would ask that Judge Herndon's orders be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Ms. Christensen?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address the government's last point first regarding the Marlett case, which I believe does apply in this situation. It's a very similar case to this one.
I don't think it's similar at all, because what happened there was the insurance company corresponding to the bank, it paid the claims, but then the victims turned around and sued it further. And so it ended up, having additional losses. That's as if here, after the bank made these people whole, they decided, bank made us whole, but why stop there? We think the bank was careless and irresponsible. Let's sue the bank for, you know, punitive damages or something. And then the bank has to pay punitive damages. If that were added on to the loss, that would be the Marlin case. But here, there isn't that pyramiding of losses. It just happens that the bank picked up the tab instead of the home buyers. If it hadn't picked, they would have been stuck with a loss. It would be the same a punishment consequence.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. One is that there are still, as far as I know, home owners or customers who are suing the bank for punitive damages. And in the bank's agreements with the customers.
Yes, but they're not arguing for a heavier sentence for Castellano because of these additional losses to which the bank may be exposed. So what difference does that make?
They are arguing that the past losses, the ones the bank did
right,
pay.
Of course, but that you don't have that double counting. The bank took the hit instead of the home buyers. Didn't take a bigger hit. Now, if it has to pay punitive damages, yeah, there'll be the bigger hit, and then the Marlett case comes in. But that's irrelevant to Castellano. He's been sentenced.
Part of the contract between the customer and the bank in settling their claims, the ones who did settle, was an agreement not to pursue punitive damages. Therefore, it would be argued.
It has nothing to do with anything. Because they're not saying that because the bank may be liable for punitive damages, Castellano should be punished more heavily than otherwise. They were saying that Marlett would be a case against them.
The logical link I'm trying to make is that the bank agreed to settle in consideration of having to pay punitive damages in addition to building the homes. And those are the costs that were considered to be because of their fault that Mr. Castellano should not be responsible for, either in the amount of loss or in the restitution. And that is why I believe that this is similar.
So you
to
think that the amount the bank paid, the bank forgave these home buyers is greater than the loss they suffered? Because
yes, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence of that?
There is evidence as to homeowners who had a contract with the bank to settle and also claimed restitution for amounts to fix their home even further. There's also evidence that the bank incurred certain costs in settling these potential lawsuits, which did not have anything to do with Mr. Castellano's fraud. They'd be consequential to that.
Let me ask you about the first point again. Mr. Goldsmith, when he read Judge Herndon's rationale for this attributing these gross receipts to Castellano, it made it sound as if what Judge Herndon was saying, that this corporation was a complete fraud, so that it has no legal significance, should be disregarded. So what's wrong with that argument?
I believe that flies in the face of what the facts of this case are, is that it was a legitimate corporation and operating as such.
Well, it is very odd. Why did Monty get all the stock?
Well, I will correct Mr. Goldsmith's factual recitation in that matter. Monty came onto the scene later. Monty's idea was to incorporate the company, presumably for tax benefits, as most people do incorporate companies, and liability benefits. Monty made himself the 100% shareholder because Mr. Castellano did have some credit problems, a previous bankruptcy. And that was the reason Monty was 100% shareholder, but that it was not to avoid himself.
Yes, but you're using his 100% shareholding as one of your shields against attributing these gross receipts to your client. So if this 100% stock of Monty is just a fraud on creditors, why should it be down to the benefit of your client?
I don't believe that it was a fraud on creditors. There are also other factors that Monty was operating a substantial amount of this company. His name was the only name on the bank account for much of the
makes
conspiracy.
It worse, right?
I'm sorry. Part
of the fraud against the creditors.
That Monty's name was on the. I don't believe so. That he was paying the bills and paying the subcontractors and doing all of that. He was controlling the money. I don't believe that.
Was he controlling the money? That's hard to believe.
He was writing the bills. He was the only one on the bank account.
Anyone can write a check. That doesn't mean you control anything.
Well, Your Honor, I see that my time is up. May I have a moment to conclude?
Sure.
I certainly would encourage this court to reverse Mr. Castellano's sentence and remand to the district court for resentencing without the sentencing enhancements as given by the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're not taking a position that there is no number here. You're just contesting the four level over $1 million.
With the $1 million?
For the loss. So
correct.
What is the loss?
The actual loss or the gross receipts?
What's the loss that the district judge should look to in applying the guidelines?
For the gross receipts, Your Honor, I don't have an answer for that because of the record and the way it exists. In this case, I don't agree with Mr. Goldsmith that it was $4 million. My recollection of the trial record was not that that's what the gross receipts were. They were talking about loss.
Well, right now, all the judge found is that it's more than $1 million, right?
Correct. But in that...
How much do you think it ought to be?
The government's accountant,
I believe. How much do you think it ought to be?
It's very difficult for me to put a number on it, Your Honor, because of this. I believe it's less than $1 million. I believe
well,
that
it's yeah, if you thought it was more, then you wouldn't be here.
Probably not.
How much is it?
Significantly less. My guess would be it's less than $500,000. I think you have to consider what he got. Includes salary and includes some salary for his wife. And we are not denying the fact that the company paid some of his personal expenses as well. But the company also paid Monty's personal expenses and had its own obligations, all of which has to be considered to assess that amount.
Well, how much did the bank reimburse these 27 home buyers for?
Approximately $1.2 million. I don't know the exact
number.
And
how did that figure in the sentence?
Into his sentence?
It's considered
as part of the amount of loss, and then added on top of that are what the subcontractors lost, and then there's some additional expenses.
So this gross receipts thing is an enhancement on top of top of the sentence for the amount.
Yes,
of
it's
loss.
On top of amount of loss,
top
of it's
amount
on top
loss.
Of rolling the offense. It's separate from all of those considerations.
Okay, well thank you very much, Mr. Smith.
You
know, we thank the defender's office for
vigorous
defense. Fine.